Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. And we're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Rick O'Donovan, who is a hammer dulcimer player who is in town for just a short time. Right now, I would like to welcome Mike Daisy. He's a monologuist, and his director and collaborator is here, Jean-Michelle Gregory. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to have you here. Now, you are doing a performance, and it's part of the Lensic Under Construction series, New Works in Progress. It's called If You See Something, Say Something, and it's Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night at the Lensic. Now, this is about homeland security and the secret history thereof. Is that correct?
Yes. It's about a number of different threads interwoven together. It's about the Department of Homeland Security and the whole apparatus around it and how it came to be formed after 9/11 and then the sort of checkered history it's had over the last 5 or 6 years. But it's also about the town of Los Alamos. And it's also about this trip I took last year to the Trinity Blast site, where the first nuclear weapon was detonated in the desert here in New Mexico, and it's also about the biography of Sam Cohen, who is the father of the neutron bomb, who's the one who actually invented the idea of the weapon that would kill only people and leave infrastructure intact. And so what I hope it will do is that it weaves together these different threads to kind of try to comment on and say something about security and how we value security and what we're willing to sacrifice for security. And
what security even means, I would imagine.
Yes. As I think it's a fascinating thing that, you know, regardless of where you stand in the political spectrum, everyone values security. Like, there are no people who want to be insecure. Like, there's no one that's actually a core value of. So it makes an interesting continuum because you really do have to choose for each person. And then a culture at large has to choose, you know, what amount of rights are we willing to give up to ensure that we are secure? And what relationship is there between the giving up of rights and the gaining of security? And those are sort of the questions that play in the piece.
Now, this is a real New Mexico piece. You're a New York artist. Did you do a lot of the research and work out here?
Yes, I did. I came out last fall and took that trip and did research on the piece and went up to Los Alamos and met Ed Grothas and went to the Black Hole. Which,
tell people about Ed and the Black Hole.
Yeah, I feel like I'm preaching to the converted because I just visit and everyone listening here probably lives here.
But not everyone, it's, you know.
But it's really not well known, which is one of the things that drew me to the story. The whole story is actually made up of these things that are out in the open that aren't well known, like the Department of Homeland Security. There are many things about it that people don't know. Ed Grothas runs this junk shop, huge junk shop called the Black Hole in Los Alamos. And you won't find it on the visitor guide, and you won't find it in any of the official publications of Los Alamos. It's not acknowledged by anyone in any power, but it's huge. It's this huge amount of excess military hardware, and he runs this junk shop where he collects. HESA calls it the world's largest pile of nuclear waste. It's leftover things made by the weapons laboratories up in Los Alamos, and he pulls them all together and he sorts them so you can go there and see, like, you know, nuclear weapon triggers, 5 for $1, and there'll be a pile of them. And he'll walk you around and show you the anthrax cooker that he has that is, you know, the same anthrax cooker that Bush was hoping to find in Iraq and never did find. But one was thrown out at the labs, and he took it.
And it can be yours.
And it could be
1999.
Yours. Yeah, and it's sitting there. And I felt like, you know, hearing about Ed, even before I came on the trip, I was really compelled by wanting to see this person in the flesh. He'd actually worked in the weapons laboratories and decided that it wasn't conscionable. And but you know, people decide to make decisions about their workplace. They often leave their workplace and maybe leave the area. He made a very striking decision to stay in the area and become this incredibly, you know, very idiosyncratic, outspoken voice. And so I met with him, and I spent time tromping around all through the crazy junkyard. And the trip to Trinity also was very much the same kind of thing where, you know, everyone has heard of this place where the first atomic weapon was detonated. But I think it's fascinating that, you know, it's only on this first, there's the first Saturday in October that you're allowed to go to the site. Even though, you know, there's a monument there that's for all people. But no one can see it because it's in the middle of the secure installation. And I think it's interesting, this idea that things can be free, like our rights are being respected. But only on one day a year. The rest of the time, no one can ever see the site.
And sort of like the free speech zones.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. And so I think it was those things metaphorically that that drew me even to the area. And I had a lifelong obsession with nuclear weapons and nuclear power. And so I think those were the things that drew me to the area.
We're talking to Mike Daisy. The piece is called If You See Something, Say Something. And by the way, we're going to be doing a ticket giveaway at the end of the show, at the end of the segment. So stay tuned for that. Lots of tickets are going to be available. So tell us something that we don't know about the Homeland Security Department. Starting with me, I don't know pretty much anything.
Okay. You know, I'll Here's a really good one. There are no detectors in service anywhere in the nation, in any airport, that could ever possibly detect explosives in your shoes. There's not one detector running that has the ability to detect the explosives that were in the shoes that the shoe bomber was wearing. The only explosives that could be detected in your shoes would be really crude, like I stuffed my shoes full of firecrackers, and then you would...
And they show up on the x-ray.
Yeah, and then they would show up on the x-ray. Other than that, there's no ability currently. They're still talking about finding the ability. The reason we all take off our shoes every time we go through and put them in is that there is no reason that we all take off our shoes and put them in the scanner. We do that because it's believed that it'll make us feel more secure. And I think a lot of what the department does and a lot of what our government does is built around making us feel secure. Although, ironically, a lot of these things that make us feel secure often involve stripping away our rights. So we lose rights so that we feel secure in a generalized way, except that by reminding us of why we're insecure, we actually become more fearful. So,
Now, that's amazing. How did you find out that those explosive detectors don't work or are non-existent?
I've just been reading about it on the internet for many years. I mean, Bruce Schneier, a very prominent security author and expert, who's testified in front of Congress and has talked a lot about exactly, you know, what security means. We always say in a post 9/11 world, but actually always meant it's the same security. It's talked about it for years and years, and it's none of it's hidden. I mean, and none of it is conspiracy theory. I mean, it's very openly documented. The entire process the Homeland Security Department goes through to do anything is so slow and laborious, and involves a huge amount of money given to military contractors. So you can see the bids and the fighting to get the contracts to build something that could maybe someday detect an explosive issue. At which point, we all have to be clear that only the world's most retarded terrorist would not have thought of something new at that point. So it's incredibly reactive security. Like, it's really stupid. And I think that's one of the things that motivates me to talk about it, is that I think we have this feeling in our hearts often where we're like, God, it just seems like we're really stupid. Like, how could it actually still be orange alert? How could we actually have only 5 ratings in the alert system and then we stay on rating 4 forever? Like, how is that useful? And it's not. It's not useful at all. It's only useful in the context that if we always think we are about to have a nuclear holocaust, which would be, you know, Because really, we only have one more rating, is red, which means that the attack is happening right now. All the planes have to come out of the sky. Things will be shot down. You know, the walls are weeping in the streets. It's apocalypse. Like, we only have one more rating. If we had 10 ratings, that would be information. And then people actually have a sense of what was going on. And if people had a sense of what was going on, people who control access to that information wouldn't have as much control as they do now. It is easier for them and more manageable to just say, it's orange. It's always almost apocalypse. Just plan that way, and then we don't have to think about it anymore.
And what is gained for them by having us in a state of fear and sort of always on pins and needles and having this, as you put it, and I've feel this way myself often when I go through airports, just ridiculous false sense of security caused by having to do things like go through the scanner practically naked. What's gained? I mean, what do they achieve?
Power. Naked power. I mean, you make people afraid in order to assert power. I mean, a lot of the show, of what the show I'll be doing, this monologue, I'm trying to connect what I think are two very related things. I mean, if there's a statement I'm trying to dissolve away, it's the idea that everything changed on September 11th. And I was in Lower Manhattan on September 11th, and many things changed for me. But I am now, it's very clear to me now that my country did not change. The systems in place, the things that have altered, the climate change, is part of a long-term gigantic systematic systems that are already in place. And you look at the history of the Cold War, and the show is going to, I think, talk a lot about the neutron bomb and the rise of the giant military-industrial complex that has its roots in Los Alamos. You know, we remember Los Alamos as this amazing town where these scientists did this thing and they fought this heroic battle. And that story is true. But it is also true that it is a town where scientists under duress did a thing that may or may not have been necessary, and then that town was transformed into a massive weapons complex that is the deadliest place in the history of the world, which is something that fascinates me about the New Mexican landscape, the way that it sits in relationship, the way that I've never met more people who talk about singing to their crystals, and like the UFOs are visiting them, and they're full of love, and to me, they're flaky. They're very flaky.
Now, hang on. I thought those, I mean, I came here in the early 90s, and there was way more of that than there is now. Did you find a lot of that crystal stuff?
Enough, more than I was used to. I mean, what I thought, though, that was interesting is I feel like it exists. I almost wonder if it's a sort of sympathetic reaction to having, I mean, really, the arms culture of the United States and therefore the world, like the primary empire building, happens right here. From where we're talking this cafe, it's 20-30 minutes up the road. And I think that it causes an interesting schism in, like, in, you know, like your psyche as you're trying to, like, you're like, you come, you with the desert, the air is beautiful, you want to be free and open, but it's hard to square that with what actually runs the economy. And I feel like in microcosm, that's the story of the United States as a whole, you know? Like, we want to be free and open, we talk about liberty greatly. But what pays for the liberty underneath is painful. It's painful to think about. And so the show is going to, I think, try to weave together this chain to sort of talk about how what happened in the desert at Trinity, that bomb detonating, there is a link, an experiential link, which is not the same as a causal link. I'm not saying one causes the other. There's a link between that moment that a small group of men working with giant resources managed to change history forever in the desert. There's a link between that and the moment that another small group of determined people flew improvised kinetic weapons into buildings and changed that world forever. There's a link in the sense that these people alter things and then the whole climate starts to shift. But it's not something that happens overnight. It's a part of a phase of empire building that's been going on for a really long time.
I think it's important also for people living, whether it be here in New Mexico or anywhere, to talk about this stuff, think about it, and work with the ideas in an artistic medium. For example, your monologues, as opposed to, you know, just reading endless biographies of Robert Oppenheimer or whatever else it is.
Yeah, and that's the hope. I mean, the show, The show, if it's, it'll be like my other monologues. It's woven together from the personal and the experiential things I've experienced and seen, things I have read about and can report on, and then it's also personal stories from my own life. And the attempt in doing that is to be vulnerable and like sort of make, forge a connection, because that's often what's missing in punditry. You know, like if it was a position paper, it would polarize. Like I'm not terribly interested in becoming the Noam Chomsky of the theater, because Noam Chomsky has no charisma. Man has anti-charisma. I can't fathom. Some of his, he may be very articulate, but oh my God, you listen to him and you just like want to drive a nail through your forehead. And so, I'm trying to do instead is humanize the whole situation. So I know that my stories of going to the Trinity site are not just stories of like metaphor. It's about like the very interesting people who chose to go that day. And I spent a lot of the day with an Iraq veteran who was there, and we talked about Blackwater, and he'd worked with Blackwater people in Iraq. And like, I just know that the human stories are what make things work. The title is "If You See Something, Say Something," which is the motto of the Department of Homeland Security, and it's the motto on all the subways in New York. We see it every day, and I use it in the show to reference that, but also to say that it's actually good advice. And if we see something, we should say something.
Which is what I'm
trying to do. So that's the idea.
We're talking to Mike Daisy, and the performance, If You See Something, Say Something, is Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, June 26th through 28th at 7:30 at the Lenzik Performing Arts Center in Santa Fe. 988-1234 is the number, and we're going to be giving away tickets in just a little while. Jean-Michelle Gregory has been sitting very quietly by. You are the collaborator and director. How do you work together, and how do you direct something that is essentially under construction and really being worked on here with the audience in Santa Fe?
Well, it's very exciting, and I'm really excited to be here, because I'll tell you that on Thursday night when Mike performs the show, it will be the very first time that the story has ever been told out loud. We don't have any pre-rehearsals beforehand. We have a lot of conversation, much like the conversation that you're having right now. We pass back and forth lots of articles and books and whatnot and just sort of talk. But really, then Mike goes off after we leave the studio today, this cafe studio. But, you know, he goes off and he creates this outline and then performs the show from that outline. And so then once that thing is built, then that's where I really come in as like an editor and sort of looking at the different storylines and, you know.
And even over the 3 days here, we'll meet every day.
Oh, the 3 days here are going to be hugely important. It's always, you know, we sort of use this birth metaphor, like the first time the story is told, we think of it as like giving birth to it, because we have all these hopes and ambitions for it, and we're, you know, fascinated by it, and we wonder what it's going to look like and how it's going to be, and then it comes out, and then we're like, okay, now what do we do with it? How do we shape it? How do we bend it? So these 3 nights at the Lenzik are going to be, the show's going to shift a lot, I predict, from night to night to night. And really,
so people can come multiple nights.
It'll change quite a bit, I suspect. It's impossible to say how much, but every one of my performances, they're never scripted. So, I mean, line by line, things shift tremendously.
Mm-hmm. So once you get a performance down, you've sort of got the feel of it, you've been doing it for a while, does it become more regular, more like the same from night to night, or does it still continue to change a lot?
It continues to change a lot. It's both. It continues to change a lot compared to like a written piece. But what happens is, it's like going up a mountain. Like, there's a mountain, and that's the performance. And every time you tell the story, I have this outline, so I have these places I want to get to. And you eventually figure out how you want to climb the mountain. And then as you do that again and again, you actually wear a path, you know, up the mountain.
Right.
So on any given day, I could just decide, I'm not following the path. I'm just going to climb up that sheer rock face. And every once in a while, we do. But usually, you know, you kind of follow the path because you try to carve the best possible path, and then that becomes the one that you follow. So over time, they do tend to become more similar night after night. Like, we just finished a run in New York off Broadway, and we were doing the show for 3 months, and it became, you know, much more regular, but still shifting, you know, 5-10% a night in terms of how the connections are made, how I get from one section to another.
Yeah, I think the shows all sort of ride that line between that sort of live performance, extemporaneous, spontaneous feel, and then underneath it and supporting it all is this very careful composition.
Yeah, and I mean, honestly, it's like one of those things that's very unusual in the straight theatrical world. But, I mean, my work really lies somewhere between straight theatrical world and the world of stand-up comedy. And like no
it reminds me of some of Spalding Gray's work.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And like no one would be surprised. In fact, people would be very surprised. You're like, when this stand-up comic does it, it's exactly the same. People would be like, that's kind of creepy.
Yeah.
And so it's very much like that, like as the pieces form. And it makes the birthing of them very exciting. We did it here very intentionally because it's about this place. And I'm a big believer that if you can tell the truth about a place in front of those people, and it works, and you can make it work there, then it really helps you tell the truth in a larger way to other people. It'd be too easy to do it somewhere else and talk about these exotic things like the Black Hole and Ed Grothis, and it all seems so magical. I really want to do it in front of people who actually know Ed, and they know the area, and have been to the Trinity site, and like have it work here, and then have it be true.
Do you want to make a special invitation to scientists and other people who work at the lab?
Oh, of course. Of course, I like to think that if they know that I'm talking about Sam Cohen, the inventor of the neutron bomb, he's really one of those people that only people who I think are in weapons design research would know the biography of, because he's had a very checkered, fascinating history where he was very close to the leadership of our country and then radically schismed off, and his plans for these kind of weapons made this huge impact. But most of the world has no idea who he is. So that's my name drop for any scientist listening. Please
yeah,
come
everyone
by.
Everyone knows who Oppenheimer and Teller are.
Right.
I think it's also interesting, living in a place like this for as long as I have, people get really bent out of shape about the poisoning of the prairie dogs, or the height of buildings, or the price of parking, or something like that. You know, and we've got the apocalypse 25 miles away. Mm-hmm. Nobody talks mm-hmm. about it.
Well, it's also has to do with fear, in that I agree with you that we have the apocalypse. What makes it creepy and difficult is it's not just the apocalypse. What it is the potential of apocalypse.
Yeah.
And so you never know how to measure that. Whereas if the parkings have increased in price, it's like I can see it impacting my life right here.
And you can also do something about it.
And you feel like you can do something. Although the frightening thing is that we could do something about the other half too. Like, it would not be, it seems impossible, but it would not actually be impossible to reform the defense contractor system. Like, as opposed to people in the world who are like, remove it entirely and we become somehow an utterly pacifistic people, I'll let others tackle that. I'm interested in, like, we could have a system closer to the world that existed before the beginning of the Cold War. Like, we do not need to give all the money, huge amounts of money, staggering amounts to defense contractors. Like, those businesses could be taken into the government. It doesn't actually have to run this way. And if someone was in the executive branch that wasn't beholden to defense contractors, they actually could make executive orders. And I think that Congress would have to show its hand, because they make a point. It's a fascinating. Every state has a defense contractor in it to ensure that no one can ever actually stand up to them. I would love to see them actually called to account, like made so that all the Democrats and Republicans both would vote it down. They'd say, no, we can't end the way things are now. And then that'd be a heck of a vote to see.
Yeah, and it takes people like Jeremy Scahill, who wrote Blackwater, to even bring it to the consciousness of people, and doesn't necessarily stay there for very long.
Yes.
Do you talk about, I mean, when one talks sometimes to folks from Los Alamos who are happy and proud of the work they do, and of course not everybody there works directly in weapons, they sort of talk about the nuclear deterrent and then the conversation's over. Do you address that in your piece?
Well, I don't know yet, because I haven't built the piece yet. But I suspect that I will, I think I will address it in the sense that I know that some of the piece is going to be talking about the mindset of people who work on weapons programs, because that has a lot to do with Sam Cohen's story. And Sam Cohen actually wrote an autobiography late in life called Shame that was about his involvement in weapons research, some of which he repudiated, some of which he didn't. He was very proud of some of the developments. He just didn't like how they were implemented after they went through the hamburger-making process of government. And a huge...
What did he repudiate?
What he repudiated is that he acknowledged that he believes that he worked on weapons programs because as a young man, when he was a child, that he was beaten by his parents really severely. And he would fantasize constantly. He's abused. And he would fantasize constantly when they'd be driving in the car. He'd fantasize about a world where his vision was always that his parents in the front are gone, his sister is gone, and so the car is empty. He's sitting in his seat, and he looks out the window, and everyone is gone. Rakes are falling down. There are lawnmowers. This is his constant fantasy. This is what he soothed himself with.
Oh, my goodness.
And he talks very clearly. He says, like, I'm proud of the work I've done, but it's very clear that I invented the neutron bomb because I was trying to, on some level, realize this vision of
that
removing people. And I think
that one had, that he had at the
that
age
he had
of...
As, that he had as a young child. And I think that, and he makes the argument, and I'm going to talk about it on stage, I'm sure. He makes the argument that to be involved in weapons programs and to be a scientist, you are not an egghead. There's this perception, you're like, they're just so involved in math. They don't realize what's going on, but that's not true. Especially, this isn't people building the gadget back at the beginning. People are sitting around working out exactly how much radiation is absorbed by a cement wall, what exactly is the lethal dose for an 8-year-old child. Like, you sit all day doing these calculations, you have to have a love for destruction and a certain love for the wonkiness of it. And I have a strain of that in my own life. I grew up loving the idea of nuclear apocalypse. I grew up thinking that the world, we were going to end in a nuclear war, and I loved it on some level. And I think that informs my own decisions about what I'm interested in. I know it informed Sam Cohen's, and I'm sure it'll inform the piece, because I think that love for, that fascination for destruction is potent. It's sort of a mythology that's bigger than anything rational.
We're talking to Mike Daisy. The performance is called If You See Something, Say Something, and it is part of the Under Construction New Works in Progress series at the Lensic. It's Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. The director and collaborator is Jean-Michel Gregory. It's happening Thursday through Saturday at 7:30, and we are going to give away 15 pairs of tickets per night, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Lots and lots of tickets. We want the place full. The Lensic wants the place full. And so if you want to call, here's the number to call, and you can call now, 428-1528. That's not the regular number, 428-1528. And you can press some number to, when you hear my name, Mary Charlotte, and say your name very clearly, say your phone number very clearly, and say what night you want a pair of tickets for, and we will call you back to confirm. It'll be first come, first served. And you may want to give a second choice if you have a second choice. Hope this works. Sort of bureaucratically complicated, but anyway, that's the best we can do. And Mike Daisy and Jean-Michel Gregory, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having us.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Rick O'Donovan. He is a hammer dulcimer player, and he will be performing his... Is this how you say it? Ameri-Celtic? Ameri-Celtic?
Ameri-Celtic.
Ameri-Celtic,
yeah,
music.
It's a blend of Americana and Celtic.
Right. On Thursday, June 26th at 7 o'clock at Fuller Lodge in Los Alamos, and then Friday, June 27th at 7 o'clock at the Green Palace Tea House here in Santa Fe. It's great to have you, and we're here set up with your actual hammer dulcimer.
Yeah, yeah. It takes up a lot of room at the cafe, but nobody ever complains.
What is the hammer dulcimer? Where does it come from?
It originates Well, ethnomusicologists argue about this one, but the argument goes between China around 3000 BC in the Ming Dynasty and more stronger argument for Mesopotamia, what is now Iraq, actually, the Persian world. The Santur came out of that whole culture and the Muslim Moorish musical.
I was reading the Wikipedia entry on the hammer dulcimer, and it said it basically gave the name of this instrument in about 20 different languages, and it exists seemingly everywhere but Africa.
Yeah, yeah. Africa, and I lived in Spain for a great bit, and it doesn't have much of a history in Spain as far as Europe. Spain and Holland are kind of devoid, and France, they're kind of devoid of any kind of history of this instrument.
So how did you start playing it?
Well, I was playing around the mid-90s. I was playing in bands, playing drums. I'm a trained jazz drummer. And guitar, and I would flip-flop in all these alternative rock bands playing drums and playing guitar and playing bass in the next one. And a friend of mine said, you ought to try the dulcimer. You hit strings. So it's got a percussive aspect and a melodic aspect. So I went to a music store, started playing one, and I walked out with it.
Now, can describe it for our listeners, because we can't see it on the radio.
It's what they call a board zither. It has mine. This particular one I'm playing has 58 strings. So, as a touring artist, it's there aren't many of us touring with the dulcimer without a roadie. I don't have one. So there's 58 strings to worry about, and there's two bridges that are strung across the soundboard. And the strings are struck with hammers, what are really called hammers, but they're very light wood implements, sticks, some people call them. I used to scoff at that, and I got over that kind of... I used to have an attitude about people saying, you're sticks. It just sounded very... raw to me. You
sounded sort of... It's drum-like.
Yeah. But that'll do. I mean, that's best to describe it. They're like sticks, and they're very light, and they're used to produce sound out of the strings. So.
Now, I associate it with things like Celtic music and to some extent bluegrass as well.
Yeah, in America, it has a really an Appalachian tradition,
right?
And that's where it's primarily. You know, Michigan is a big state for the dulcimer. West Virginia. In Ireland, oddly enough, it didn't really have any presence until this century, when sort of it came about actually through the trade through the Eastern Europe to Western Europe and started in shipping ports like up in Northern Ireland. Guys would go out to sea and they'd buy one in Turkey or, you know, and they'd bring it back and then start playing Irish tunes on it. And they were like, oh, wow, this is suitable for Irish tunes.
Isn't that interesting? Because it really sounds like it was born and raised in Ireland.
Yeah. And I spent a lot of years living over there and I had a corner on the market because it was instantly likable. People loved the sound. And, you know, there's maybe a handful of players in the country of Ireland. So I was one of a few.
How is it tuned? Are there limitations in what keys you can play in?
No, Mary Charlotte, it's basically like it's fully chromatic, mine. Now, I've got mine tuned to kind of suit mainly Western folk music, like Irish music. But sometime over the next year, my dream is to get a Santori, which would just not sound terribly different, but with just the ease of getting some of those Arabic scales and so forth, it's a logistical thing with the musician. I have to sometimes stretch really far to get that D sharp, you know, and play the Arabic kind of scales.
Right.
Which I did last time I was in Santa Fe. I actually played with a belly dance troupe, which
is
something
right?
I hadn't done in years. I played a long time ago in Nashville with one, so it was a great night. It was just very memorable when you're on the road. You know, these different things that turn up become very memorable and special. But it's a workout. That music is a real workout, playing it.
We're talking to Rick O'Donovan. Now, it's not O'Donovan. It's Rick O.
That's right. It's very confusing. And most of the time I get to a town and I go to the venue and they've got, if there's a poster or a marquee up, it'll say Rick O'Donovan.
Right.
Because it's confusing. I don't know what I'm going to do about it. I'm going to change my name.
you have to take a big breath between your first and last name.
Yeah.
Do you want to play something for us?
Yeah, I think maybe while we're on the subject of Ireland, I'll play a Carolyn piece. Carolyn being the blind itinerant harpist. So these tunes he composed for the harp. And this is one called the Megan Morgan.
Donovan, is it exhausting?
No, it's enjoyable. And I never get tired of that music. I've been playing it for years now. And
you have to keep such a light touch with the mallets, because sometimes you strike them very firmly and sometimes they bounce and you get it hitting the string a couple of times.
Yeah, you've got a great view of that. You're looking right across it,
right.
You know. And sometimes I forget, because I was brought up playing traditional music on the west coast of Ireland in noisy pubs with fiddle players. And the two things I've had to learn to change playing solo is, one, beating to get volume and to be heard, And the second is to play slower tempos when you're playing for a listening audience. You're not playing for dancers, and you're not keeping up with fast and furious fiddle players. And the jigs and the reels actually sound really nice at a nice, easy tempo sometimes.
So you don't play for dancers with this instrument?
I did a few ceilidhs over in Ireland when I was over there. But primarily what I'm doing now on this tour is singer-songwriter, and it's listening rooms and unlistening rooms, like noisy bars in Texas. I did a few of those.
Right.
It's a mixture of venues, but they're all kind of folks are either listening or congregating and socializing, that sort of thing.
Now, a tune like the one you just played, is that a tune that traditionally has words, it's about something?
That one, that particular one doesn't. That's just a tune that was written by Carolyn, who was really, Carolyn is really Irish classical music. He was an itinerant harpist that composed tunes for patrons to make his way. He was also blind. And back in the 1700s, he was just composing these very, I think, Baroque music, and music that was going on the continent really influenced his compositional style. And it's really like classical music. Some of his tunes have words that were either put to them later or at the time, you know, folks that he was writing for a wedding, an event like that for a patron, they might put words to commemorate it. But some do and some don't. That particular one, I'm not aware of any lyrics to it.
Now, I can't resist asking you if you could play even just a few bars of something that you might use to accompany a belly dancer.
Oh, wow.
It's such a different sound. Can you play it on this particular instrument?
Yeah. I believe I could do that.
Different sound.
Yeah.
So, I mean, one thing that is happening everywhere is that no matter what the style of music is, it's mixing with another style, electronic styles, popular styles. What's the trajectory of this instrument into contemporary music and even pop music, if there is one?
Well, you know, it last time I was playing here, I had a chance to play with Michael Cott, the cellist, around Santa Fe, and hopefully we'll be able to hook up at one of my gigs and play again. But I remember him talking about how, about trance, about like sort of repetitive music really catching on with the youth, and that kind of is a pointer for me, you know. This instrument might foray into electronica in that way. I have yet to kind of meet up with the right collaborator. At the times I have, I've always been kind of scooting. I moved out of Ireland just when I met someone who was really doing a lot of trip-hop and so forth. And that was actually a friend of mine who I trusted and knew, and I liked his work and so forth. But I'm not discounting that possibility.
Now, you also sing along with this instrument, which is, I think, somewhat unusual.
Yeah, it is somewhat unusual, what I learned was basically this instrument is a precursor to piano, and it's the same fundamental idea that hammers strike strings. But the difference when you're singing and playing piano is that your fingers are right on the keys, so you can look up at the audience easier. It's much easier. Your fingers are right on the notes, and you can play blind, if you will, easier.
This one you can't. You really have to look at what you're doing.
This one I can. I've developed... But it's taken a lot of time. When I first started singing with it, I'd have my head buried in it, and folks would say that as a critique, look, you know, it's really nice, it's a nice song, but, you know, when you're performing, you need that energy flow with the audience. And so I've learned to kind of simplify what I'm doing. If I'm going to accompany myself, there is enough complicated tunes that I can show off all I want and shut my mouth.
Singing,
yeah.
Right.
So when I do, and generally when you're singing, you know, simple accompaniment is so much more effective anyway. And anything from rock music to folk music, you know, and sometimes it's like you just pare it down. The simpler, the better.
So that you can really focus on the voice and the singing and the expression in the voice.
And even instrumental music, the simpler forms, you know, it's the overcomplicated stuff that gets a little bit too much sometimes. I think Frank Zappa used to call jazz music guys playing a lot of notes to sound like really cool. Now, I mean, that's not me. That's Frank Zappa.
One can understand the sentiment. Rico Donovan is a hammer dulcimer player, and he'll be playing his Ameri-Celtic music on Thursday, June 26th at 7 o'clock, the Guitars and Gâteaux series at the Fuller Lodge in Los Alamos, and then on Friday, June 27th at 7 o'clock at the Green Palace Tea House here in Santa Fe, and then also you'll be right here at the Santa Fe Baking Company.
Yeah, you know, I love coming in here. You know, I play right here where we're sitting right now, and I've done it the last two tours I've hooked up with Kevin and Eric and been able to do that. And it's really nice. I usually get a little audience around my corner. You know, they get curious. And
When will you be here?
Saturday at 12 noon and Sunday at 1:30, which are nice times to play, you know.
Rico Donovan, thank you so much for being with us. Do you have a website?
I have a website. It's I'm totally on MySpace now. I had a website I ditched, and I'm completely MySpace, as a lot of people are doing. It's MySpace Rico Donovan, RICKODONOVAN, and Hammer Dulcimer. I cornered the Hammer Dulcimer domain. So.
Oh, great. Would you like to, instead of our regular Cuban outro music, would you like to play a little bit of outro while we close the show?
Sure, yeah. Okay, sounds great.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte, and we'll see you tomorrow.